Hello, everyone. I'm Luis, and this is The Debrief, a podcast from Incident.io. I think it's fair to say that AI is here to stay. So as companies grapple with this reality, they're putting their best foot forward to build AI features that really make a difference for their customers. But should you be building these features if there's no obvious fit in your product? And even if there is, are you making sure to stay true to your product principles? The reality is that deciding to build AI into your product isn't a decision you just make on a whim. There are tons of considerations around how to do it right, many of which we wrestled with ourselves when we were building our AI features just a few months ago. So in this episode of The Debrief, I sat down with our CTO, Pete Hamilton, and product manager, Ed Dean, to get some perspective around how we weighed the decision to build with AI and how we thought about principles along the way. If you've been considering whether or not to build AI features, then you'll definitely want to listen to this episode. There's a ton of really great wisdom imparted in this one, so let's just get right into it. Here's my conversation with Pete and Ed. Pete and Ed, thank you so much for joining us on another episode of The Debrief. This time around, we're talking about practical lessons for companies that are trying to build AI-enabled products. And I think where I want to start is that it's hard to get around the fact that AI is on a bit of a roller coaster. You know, you had this like really high peak, and then people were like, oh no, this is not it. And then it went, you know, hype died down a little bit. Now it's back up. And now it feels like we're at a point now where we're back to where it all started. So from a personal perspective, I'd love to hear how each of you view the state of AI in general.
Yeah, good question. Big question. My take on this, I think it comes in, I think, waves of interest, right? And that you have the really, really early side of a new technology where you have the kind of, you know, the people right on the edge who are playing with it. No one else has even thought of what you can do with it yet. They're kind of doing all the proof of concepts. The chat GPTs of the world don't exist yet. But like LLMs have existed for like a while, for example. And so you have like that wave. Then you have the kind of like holy shit realization moment where someone does something where they really demonstrate the value of the thing. And suddenly that spawns like a whole wave of experimentation. And that's super exciting, right? And that was the ChatGPT moment like a couple of years ago or a year and a bit ago. And then you have this sort of like well of, I guess, like sort of exploration or like disillusionment where people are like, oh, it's not actually like quite as practically useful as I thought it was. Like, it's really shiny, but actually, like, how do you use this in practice? And then I think you move into an interesting era where people start to like really nail the use cases and they start to figure it out, as it were. And I think, to me, that's where I think we are now, is kind of, you know, you're seeing companies like really nail this. You're seeing, you know, lots of experiments turning into really practical, you know, applications of the technology. And yeah, it's super exciting. So I think now is probably the most exciting time since the kind of initial ChatGPT craziness for me. So yeah,
I definitely second that. I mean, this is a huge simplification, but the way I see it is ChatGPT comes out, people learn what large language models are, and then there's a lot of excitement around foundation models. Companies like Anthropic are getting started. Mm-hmm. It gets more competitive, and then I think some sentiment started to emerge that things were sort of tending towards being just like a new foundation for the big compute companies. So like maybe AWS make a bit more money, but things aren't changed that dramatically. I think that probably came from the fact that around that time, other than ChatGPT, which was obviously an incredible success, there wasn't that much that was that compelling on the application front. Whereas I think what we're seeing now is a kind of Cambrian explosion of things that people are just trying. Some of them will work, some of them won't in the application layer. And people are kind of pushing the boundaries of what's possible there as well. There's companies like Cognition AI with Devin, who have these really cool agentic workflows and totally new UIs that didn't exist in previous product experiences. So I think what we're seeing now is the application layer has gained a lot of speed, and I expect that just to continue, to be honest. And also more kind of companies that existed before this AI wave, and I think we're a good example of this, have found ways to integrate AI in kind of compelling ways in their existing workflows, instead of kind of going straight to the temptation, which was ChatGPT, you know, 100 million users, faster than ever, let's have a chatbot too. So yeah, I think people are starting to learn more from kind of a product perspective, what's working. And then we're seeing that on the usage side. And as a result, the sentiment's improving.
Yeah, I think kind of one interesting thing about I guess like where we go from here is, I think that's two, it's going to be with every new technology, there's kind of like a couple of things that happen. I think one is going to be, and I don't know when it's going to happen, but it feels like there'll be some kind of AI winter where lots of the use cases that like, because no one knows yet what's going to stick and what's going to miss. It's like, there's probably a, some subset of the market that is being created now that like can't survive. And I mean, have hypotheses about like what companies I think those are, but that's going to be very interesting, is seeing like what actually like sticks and lands as like, yes, this is a use case that you can build a $1 billion business around, use cases you can't. And then the other thing that's really, really interesting is you get like a sort of second order effect in the industry of like people building tools for people using the technology, right? And like, that's always something that kind of comes next, is you end up with like this wave of like, how do you test this? How do you like actually like engineer prompts? Like that's a, all these new things that become skills. And then when it's a skill that is tough to master, you end up with products that help people who don't have those skills do it, even though they don't have those skills. And like, yeah, so it's kind of tools for builders, and you can already see some of those emerging. Is like, how do you actually like QA your models? Like that's a problem, and now there's like six startups all trying to solve that. Yeah. So yeah, you kind of got another wave of startups yet to go, but also probably an interesting sort of industry shift of the ones that make it and the ones that don't. So
yeah, I definitely agree we'll have a lot of kind of growth in the picks and shovels aspect of the industry. Exactly. Companies like LangChain and Weavier, I expect will do really well.
100%.
I kind of have another controversial take here as well, which is that people always overestimate how good things will be in the short term and underestimate how good things will be in the long term.
100%.
And I think that's happening with foundation models now, where people are like, OpenAI to the moon, AGI in 2 years' time. And when that doesn't happen, people might be a bit disappointed, but then underappreciate how good
10 years' time, right?
LLMs will be in 10 years. Yeah. Maybe LLMs will probably be the wrong framing by then, how good these kind of agentic systems, for example.
Yeah, it's like LLMs sort of, you know, become the equivalent of how we look at like a linear regression today. Or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, oh yeah, those are just like LLMs. Just like, who knows? It's exciting.
Yeah. From my perspective, it's been fascinating to see the sort of shift from AI equals chatbot. And I think we're going to talk about this later, actually, to people realizing the infinite potential. And you understand, like, you know, when these things are first rolling out, people are seeing it for what it is. It's like, man, this just looks like a chatbot. But, you know, after spending some more time with it, they realize that, like, the sky's the limit. So yeah, really curious to see like how these products continue to evolve. But I'm curious, like obviously Incident.io is in the incident management space, and it feels like some companies have sort of jumped onto the AI train. So curious like what your thoughts are about the state of AI within the context of incident management.
Kind of my overarching view is that foundation models today are nowhere near where they'd need to be to kind of have agentic workflows that go and resolve incidents for you. Not in the least because some of the biggest challenges we see in our customer base today are actually around communication and coordination and those sorts of problems, which these systems aren't positioned to solve today. That's not to say you can't accelerate response and accelerate communication with AI tools, and we'll get onto the principles that we've kind of used when thinking about that later on. Yeah, I think we're starting to see an impact in ways that people didn't anticipate. It's not like AI will automate jobs away or automate incident response, but it'll be kind of tools that affect kind of every part of incident response kind of gradually more and more over time.
Yeah, 100%. I totally agree with that. And I think, you know, I think it's also, it'd be naive of us to assume that sort of those things will never be possible. And so we obviously have like sort of an eye on the future, as it were, and trying to think like, you know, what's next? Like where's the next opportunity coming from? Like I think disruptive or, you know, super innovative new technologies have the potential to massively accelerate existing companies like ours. But also, you know, if you're a new startup kicking off tomorrow, like you have a really unfair advantage over the companies that had to do it when that technology didn't exist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the classic is the incumbent gets leapfrogged, right? Because they're too slow to adopt the new thing. And the new thing actually is so advantageous that before everyone knows it, you've totally taken over. And there's, I mean, countless examples in history of that happening. So I kind of, you know, we want to take advantage of the new technology for sure. And there's a ton of, I guess, like, you know, we can talk about this later, ways that we can do that. But, you know, also kind of want to be slightly skeptical of, you know, not overreaching right now, but you need to keep that eye on like, yeah, but we also need to, you know, pay attention, because if we don't, someone else is going to potentially just hop over us.
Another sort of broad take here is I think with like some of the AI design tools coming out of Figma or software engineering tools like Devin. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to end up with a lot more software over the next 5-10 years, and as a result, a lot more incidents. So actually,
it's good for us. Yeah. I mean, as long as the robots are just as good at creating bugs as I am, then we're going to be in business for a long time.
One thing that I did want to ask is, like, obviously, there's a lot of weight and power behind AI, and I think with that power comes a lot of responsibility. I'm wondering if you can speak to, like, how you approach this conversation of, like, being a responsible user or proponent of AI.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's also, like, super topical. So there's a conference in London recently run by Vanta, where this is obviously one of the things that sort of core to their business, but it was all about sort of trust and safety, I guess, in a world where AI now exists and is developing rapidly. And I think really good panel. Hopefully they put some of the talks online. But I guess, like, the stance that I took there and sort of would take here is, I think, you know, we do have a huge amount of responsibility. I think particularly in the industry as a whole, you know, yes, in the industry as a whole, but particularly in, like, our domain. So if you think about, you know, someone's having the worst day and, you know, potentially something's going wrong affecting, like, millions of users, I think there's several versions of influence that we have there. I think one is, you know, we're making recommendations. Like, those recommendations, you know, may not be verbatim followed, but, like, have strong influence on how someone responds to an incident. Like, if I tell Ed right now, our assessment is that the safest thing to do is, like, turn off all the databases, for all Ed knows, like, that's generated from the knowledge of, like, hundreds of senior engineers in the company, and, like, that's exactly what he should do. And sort of, you know, I guess we have a responsibility there to make sure, like, A, what we're recommending is sort of valid and important, B, that we're, like, showing our working and sort of building trust with Ed in that scenario. And so I think we have a real responsibility there to make sure that, like, if we are going to use AI to propose things or recommend courses of action, that, like, that's, you know, that's well founded. And I think the other angle, and we don't do this today, and we probably won't for quite a while, honestly, because of this reason, is, like, you know, there's a world in the future where people want systems like ours to take action. And right now, like, we're nowhere near the place where I feel comfortable, you know, allowing AI to take a role in that. It's kind of, you know, it makes me feel extremely uncomfortable. And so we're not doing it because it's not ready. And I don't feel like we can kind of, you know, confidently or authentically offer that kind of service to our customers. And it's not what they want either. They want sort of, you know, we talk about it as, like, exoskeletons, not robots. And, you know, when we talk about product principles, we can touch on that in a minute. And I think, you know, that's one of the things we bear in mind is, you know, our job is to make the things people do already much more effective and help make folks much more effective at their job, not to replace them. And I think, you know, trust and safety play a big role in that, because it's, you know, I don't feel like it is safe to trust autonomously yet. But I think suggestions, proposals, context summarization, that sort of stuff, very, very trustworthy at this point.
Yeah, for sure. Very well said, and plus one to everything you just mentioned. But Ed, I'd love to talk about our AI products or features. So recently we went live with Assistant, related incidents, suggested summaries, and suggested follow-ups. And I'm curious, like, if you can do, like, a very quick reflection on how things have been since launch. You know, what has the impact been for our customers? And sort of secondary to that is, like, has anything surprised you?
Yeah, good question. So the features we released are kind of deliberately broad. So as you mentioned, we have Assistant, which is, like, a natural language interface that's leveraging OpenAI's Assistance API, and then things like code generation as well. We had related incidents, which is uses embeddings, and then vector databases and distance between those embeddings, things like that. And then more typical summarization features like suggested summaries, suggested follow-ups that then use OpenAI again, but with JSON mode and things like that. So we can integrate them with our kind of first-class product features. That's kind of valuable for us to cover lots of ground because it just helped build up so much knowledge in the team. But what's been really interesting as well in covering lots of ground is the reception from customers has been really different. So we saw a huge amount of excitement around Assistant, which was like the natural language interface kind of ChatGPT, not quite, because it's focused at a very specific use case, but still kind of that theme. But then when it hit kind of GA, we saw tons and tons of initial adoption, and people do still use it sparingly, but the retention was lower. Mm-hmm. Whereas with suggested summaries and suggested follow-ups, I think 95% of customers use those features every single month.
Absolutely wild.
And of the engagement, we have kind of high 80s, maybe even 90% acceptance of the suggestions we have 4 follow-ups and 4 summaries. So the quality is insanely high as well.
Yeah.
And we've heard from people that they spend kind of maybe 10, 20, 30 minutes sometimes writing updates in St. Charles. Yeah. And they have to do it for every incident.
Yeah. It's like, even if you take it as like it drafts it,
yeah,
you've already saved like a ton of time.
Yeah. So these are kind of features you might have been less excited about. Sort of calling back to my first answer initially, where everyone was really excited about natural language interfaces revolutionizing everything.
Yeah.
But actually just implementing small changes to existing workflows can save people hours and hours and hours. And they're now, yeah, kind of, forget AI, some of our most loved product features. Yeah. So the adoption there has been crazy. The thing I take away from that is, for others building with AI, you should focus on your existing product principles. Whatever it is that's special about your product and your team and your company, you should lean into those things and just let AI enable you. You don't need to write a new playbook about how to build good product. And then also close the loop on that. So make sure you're being close to customers, you're tracking adoption metrics, retention, et cetera, and then learning what's working for you and doubling down in that area.
Yeah, 100%. I think it's, yeah, I was saying the other day, a meetup that Ed and I were talking at, is kind of, it's the unsexy stuff that gets the most love. It's the kind of taking something that people find hard, laborious, time consuming, and just making it like 50% easier. Like, that seems to be where AI for us is shining. And yep, it's like surprisingly stark, the difference in customer reception and engagement there. Yeah. So like I totally wasn't expecting it, for what it's worth. And it's, yeah. And now I'm like, oh, what other like boring things could we, I think a lot of companies go like, where can we add AI to our products as like, it's an AI feature. Actually, if you just go, you know, to Ed's point, where are people doing a thing 100 times a day, and how could we make it so they only have to do it 50 times a day, or that they can do it twice as fast? Those are the things that have taken off like an absolute rocket ship in the product. And we were at a meetup last night, and we had a like, one of the people was talking about these AI features sort of, and someone like literally like 3 meters away overheard and just turned around and was just like, I really like effing love AI summaries. And it's just like, cool, it'd be great if all our customers could do this at every meetup. That'd be great. But I like, that to me is just a symbol of like just how much people love these features. And yeah, we should go build like 10 times as many of them.
Yeah. I mean, the other kind of quite tactical learning for me there is, where does your product today have context, or another way of saying that is a data advantage that other products don't have?
Yeah.
So the reason our summaries are so compelling is we have so much structured but also unstructured data about incidents. There's no one else who has that kind of information. So then it means we can generate these summaries that are near human level, at least according to the acceptance rates.
Yeah.
Whereas, so I think most of the time when people hear summaries, they think again of ChatGPT putting in some prose saying, can you summarize it?
Yeah.
But it's actually very, very different when it's in context. Yeah. So where do you have that kind of advantage in terms of the data you've got in your system?
Yeah, and not just in unstructured data, right? Yeah. It's not like we look through back through all the messages and we try and, specifically picking on updates for a second, it's not that we just look back through all the messages and we summarize it. LLMs are very good at that. We also have a ton of other really valuable, like rich, high density proprietary information around, you know, all the pull requests that have been involved. We know what errors got triggered. We know, like, you know, we have text, graphs, code, like literally anything you give us can be a source of that update. Like to-do list items, like they can get included, like what stuff's still outstanding. All of this structured information plus the unstructured information is like, yeah, extremely, extremely compelling, for sure. So,
yeah. Ed, I'm still stuck on these adoption numbers. Like, that's insane, you know, the usage that we're getting out of it. One quick thing before we move on. You know, obviously from a product perspective, like you can put your best foot forward and build something that you have a lot of conviction in, but people just may not see eye to eye with it, and, you know, adoption will lag. In your experience, like, how does the adoption here compare to other products where, like, I mean, 90% is insane, but you tell me if I'm wrong or if that's normal, but I'm going to guess it's not.
Yeah, definitely not normal. Yeah, the adoption figures are unbelievable. I think it's, both of those features are kind of some of the fastest adopted features I've seen in my career. But it's not just the numbers. Like Pete said in that anecdote, people tell us they love it all the time. Yeah, it's the qualitative feedback that's been just as strong. I think in this kind of AI space, given it's so new, there's lots of uncertainty. Honestly, you just have to try a breadth of ideas, focus on getting your time to experiment on each new idea down, and then be really close to customers, let them get their hands on those features as early as possible. Mm. So we have Slack Connect channels with customers where we'll hear from them directly. We had product analytics and all those features. So anytime we'd make a tweak, like update a prompt or use a different model version, we'd be able to measure the difference in performance. We also have automation. So when customers use features and submit feedback, that gets posted directly in Slack. So yeah, iterate and experiment as quickly as you can, and then also be incredibly close to customers and close that feedback loop.
I think that the retention is the thing that I, like in my role, I'm particularly interested in as well. Not mm-hmm. that Ed isn't, like obviously it counts for both of us, but it's kind of, you know, our ability to ship great products. It's like, cool, very proud of that. I think what's very telling is that for a lot of AI features, many of ours included there, is like, there's a bit of a flash in the pan phenomenon where it's like, oh, people love it. They go, they try it, it's launch day. They go, this is really, really awesome. The thing that I'm then looking at for the subsequent 30, 60, 90 days is like, how many are coming back, right? And I think, you know, that 90% adoption is really impressive that like, you know, 9 out of 10 people using our product have at some point interacted with one of our AI features. I think what's more interesting is that like a large proportion of them come back, and that over time that number increases, right? There's not like a sort of decay curve that over time, like, you know, you find the 10% of people that are like the hardcore users of that thing. It's spiraling upward, which is really cool, right? It's like, you know, maybe 5 people are using it and then 5 other people see it. And it's like, oh, this is actually like growing. This is like a growth in our adoption graph, right? Rather than like a sort of, you know, a lag in our retention graph. So
yeah, we've seen kind of AI skeptics become believers.
Yeah.
Based on what we thought were some of the kind of simplest features we were implementing. So there's definitely lessons there for us.
Yeah.
Cool. So like obviously things are going quite well. But Pete, I'm curious if you could speak to like what was the signal that the team was ready to take this on in the first place, you know, building out these AI features? Because to me it seems like a pretty big commitment.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I guess like my short answer is it's probably not as big of a commitment as you'd think. And I think it's a lot more about the timing. So when it was probably about a year before we started like experimenting with AI features sort of in earnest in production. And we did, you know, we did what everyone did, right? It's like we took the team out for like a day and we said, right, guys, new technology, potentially groundbreaking. What can we do? Right. We took the entire engineering team and we did a hackathon and we essentially said, like, just go experiment, go see what you can build. And honestly, like the assessment off the back of that was like, it's just not ready as a technology. And the reason for that was less like the quality is really low. I think we had some good early signal on the quality, but like performance wasn't there. You know, it would take sort of 30 seconds to summarize a bunch of rich incident context. And you're like, cool, in the heat of an incident, I'm not going to sit there with a spinner for 30 seconds. Also, if you do it async, like by the time you give me the recommendation, I've moved on to something else. Like incidents move fast and it wasn't fast. So we essentially had like a really nice library of early experiments. We put some of them in place for ourselves. So we put them in our environment and we'd been playing with them and we kind of made the call that it wasn't quite ready, but we'd keep it in place and we'd keep experimenting. And like when it felt like it was getting better, then we'd revisit. And then the other thing was like, we went to customers and said sort of, you know, do you want us to, like, you know, ultimately your customers decide what you build at the end of the day to a degree. And like, they didn't care like that much. You know, you said like, do you want AI features? And they're like, no, I want this other thing that is like making my day really, really hard. Please, please, can you solve this? Don't go building shiny AI features. I just don't want that. And obviously there's some product thinking there around like, you know, they're never going to tell you. It's like, what are their problems versus what do they want? But even then, there weren't any issues that we could like put AI to work on. Move forwards like a year, and I think the real trigger was, I guess, twofold. One was performance dramatically improved. So like the speed of the technology, literally, of like, if I give a bunch of context to OpenAI, how quickly can they give us back an incredibly high quality response, was like markedly different. And so that opens up a whole new range of like options and possibilities with AI. And there's another version of that to come as well, where it's like, you know, sub-seconds, sub-milliseconds, you know, responses, like those are coming probably sooner than we think. And I'm excited for that because that for us opens up more opportunities. But that was one of the first triggers, was like, oh, that stuff that was slow, it's not slow. So now why would we not do this? The second thing was that customer understanding had massively increased. So a lot of the, I guess, like sort of front runners in the industry. So like you've got the Intercoms of the world, also like, you know, now a customer and kind of excited to, I guess, a bit of mutual beneficial AI work going on there. But like, you know, they'd done a ton of exciting stuff with Finn and, you know, you had tons of other companies doing the same thing. And what that does is sort of set expectations in the customer's minds. They're learning how like AI is not a thing to be afraid of. And actually it's a thing that you can get a lot more value out of products with. And so they're both more willing to explore it. But also, you know, someone else has gone through 9 rounds of legal red lines on like the implications of using OpenAI, right? And so we didn't have to climb that hill either. So you've got this kind of more receptive nature with customers and more potential on the product side. And those two things combined was like, cool, this feels like now the hill is not so hard to climb and we should go experiment. And yeah, that was kind of the main trigger, and then, you know, panned out really, really well. Probably could have moved a little bit earlier, honestly, but you know, as always, we had other things to build. So
Ed, in your opinion, why would teams want to integrate AI into their products in the first place? And sort of tacking on to that, why would they not want to do so?
I mean, it just opens up entirely new possibilities for what you can build. And we've seen particularly incredible returns on projects that, at least in the first version, were maybe kind of contained within a week and are now providing enormous impact. I think that pattern will continue to be true. So I definitely encourage everyone to experiment with features. I think the customer impact is massive. Why wouldn't they? I think a lot of teams feel that they're not equipped with the knowledge they need to experiment in a new domain. So it feels like a kind of significant upfront investment to build that knowledge. I think people still, and this is maybe a misconception more than anything, but people still have kind of security concerns, data concerns. I think there are really compelling stories to work around that. And we're now seeing AI used in kind of huge enterprises and provisioned by all of the main cloud providers, et cetera. So I think there's definitely a strong story there, but there's still, I would say, a misconception that there are kind of data and security issues around AI.
I think maybe touching on the second part of your question, Luis, I think like, why not add AI to your products? And I think sort of it sounds a bit trite, but it's like, if AI doesn't add any value, like don't just sprinkle it on, right? There's a kind of, you know, there's a lot of products that honestly were like, they were killer products before they did any AI stuff. And the AI is not really adding very much. And you can see it. And I kind of, you know, it's kind of in the same way, like every technology wants to be a technology company because the multiples and the VC perception is like way better. And when you go an IPO, you get technology multiples, not, you know, it's like sort of similar effects sort of happening elsewhere, which is like, oh, we're not just X, we're like AI for X now. And it's like, I don't know, you've got some slightly kind of lukewarm vanilla AI features in your product. I really think if you just doubled down on product fundamentals here, you'd have a much better ride. And I think sort of, you know, really question like, why are we adding AI to this product? It's the classic, you know, customers first, you know, their problems first. And then AI is a new tool to solve many of the world's existing problems. Not like, you know, it's a classic, like, you know, when you've got a hammer, everything's a nail. I think that's why you would not add AI. It's like, you don't start with AI and work backwards. You start with the problems and AI is one of the solutions.
Yeah, I definitely think some of that's a kind of reflexive response where people think this is a platform shift, like the internet, like mobile. If I'm not agile and I don't change now, I'll be outcompeted by a new startup. So a lot of people, I think, are integrating AI more out of fear than they are kind of from first principles, customer feedback, essentially. So yeah, I definitely encourage people to go on that journey and implement AI features, but start from the same principles you do anytime you ship a new feature.
Yeah, I think it's about sort of like tactical experimentation versus like strategic realignment of your company. It's kind of, if AI is now part of your brand, your persona, you probably overcooked it, unless you are in a domain where that is genuinely legit. I think for most companies, like, go do experimentation by all means, but like, don't assume it's a big part of your product. It's kind of, it's like, avoid being one of those companies that was X and then turned into like X, but now on blockchain. It's like, it's sort of like, you know, there was just a whole suite of companies that were kind of like, blah, 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 powered by blockchain. And you're just like, really? Like, you sort of, that's not really a thing. And I think just avoid that with AI is how I look at it. It's like, you know, what's your core product? How can AI support? Not the other way around.
Ed, you mentioned principles. I would love if you could speak to some of the product principles that we had in mind when we were building out our AI feature set.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I've kind of scattered a few throughout the conversation so far. So just to recap those are cover lots of ground technically, or another way of framing that is level up your team, give them experience in RAG and few-shot prompting, multi-shot prompting, maybe fine-tuning if you really want to push the applications further. Different interfaces like natural language. Maybe you want to play with embeddings, vector databases. So build up knowledge in your team. Another one, and this is true for all product features, but it's just be incredibly close to your customers. There's nothing more valuable than a close customer feedback loop. especially in a domain where there's more uncertainty than usual, like there is now, you really want to get feedback early and be able to course correct. A few other principles I'd mention is invest in tooling early. So this is just going to enable your cycle rate on experiments to be much faster. Yep. When we started out, there wasn't as much tooling as there is today. So we built a lot of that from the ground up. This is things like fixture tests to help you prompt and iteratively improve prompting. There's lots of things like that. Maybe it's just product analytics, tracking performance amongst your customer base when you make changes as well, A-B testing. These things aren't rocket science, but making sure you're applying them into this new domain. I'd say today there are many more picks and shovels type companies and AI. Yep. So to move as fast as possible, I'd actually encourage people to buy versus build in this situation.
100%.
There's a few other kind of product principles we'd apply. So one phrase we often use internally is exoskeletons, not robots. Kind of another way that's often referred to is having a human in the loop. So it's we want to make suggestions or efficiency improvements for our users. We don't want to fully replace workflows.
Yeah.
So always keeping that in mind, especially when it comes to kind of UI, UX. And there's a broader point there for kind of the future of AI and human-computer interaction. And maybe in the long run, we'll get to agentic workflows where things will be wholesale replaced. But with the quality of models today, I'd say we're in a world where the human should stay in the loop.
The point on iteration loops is the one that I'd really, really underscore there from a delivery perspective, at least from a product perspective. I think exoskeletons, not robots, is like spot on. And I'd encourage everyone to think like that. On the delivery perspective, I think it's the speed of those loops is essentially going to dictate the quality of your product, right? It's the classic, like, you know, 1 month on one thing or 1 month doing a thing 100 times. It's like, in what world is the thing going to be likely better? Mm-hmm. And it's like, cool, it's clearly the second one. So yeah, I'm just a firm believer in that. So our rubric was like, anything that helps us experiment quicker, move faster. Like, let's assume everything we do is going to fail. The job is then fail as quickly as possible to find the thing that works. So yeah, really, really recommend that versus over focusing on like one very specific thing and then getting it perfect. It's like, nah, just get this thing into the world, get the feedback, loop, loop, loop.
Yeah. It's also, I think, just in this domain, if you focus on getting one thing perfect, there's, I don't know, 50%+ chance. It just won't be a good feature anyway. Yeah.
Always overfitted or something, right? It's like it's the classic, like, oh, it's great in our account, and then you go into someone else's account because it's so non-deterministic in a way that is not true of like normal programming and engineering. It's like, you know, what works amazingly well with a corpus of our incident data, with, you know, even just like, for example, someone new to the platform, they only have 3 incidents by the time they get their summarization, so we can't be as useful. Or like, you know, a big company might run many different types of incident, and that changes how you need to like think about the prompting and the framing. And so, yeah, how do you learn that? And it's like, cool, you get it in prod with some design partners, you test it, you improve it, but you've got to put it into the world.
Pete, one thing that I'd love to get your perspective on, and I think we've touched on this a little bit throughout this conversation, is companies tend to make the mistake or fall into the trap of like selling this grand vision of AI that's going to change your life, that all of your problems will go away, so on and so forth. But in reality, those are huge oversells. You know, I think that obviously there is a space for AI. We've obviously found a fit within our product that's really paying off. But how did we approach this sort of problem of like not overselling the vision of what we were trying to accomplish and being very realistic and grounded and, you know, saying this is what you're going to get out of it, nothing more, nothing less?
Yeah, good question. I'd sort of divide this into two, where I actually think you do need some sort of, you know, lofty vision, or you need something that's exciting, right? It's like, you know, you know, if you're too, I guess, like myopic in your goals, it's just not as inspiring, right? People want to buy into the future of your product as much as they want to buy what you're selling today. And I think you need to give some of that, right? It's like, here's where we're going. You've got to have some of that. But when that gets confused with this is what we have today, that's where you have that misalignment of expectations. It's the classic, like, you know, the landing page looks incredible, and then you land in the product and you're like, huh, this isn't quite what was promised, right? You want to really avoid that. And it's like, oh, the flashy demo that then in practice, like, just doesn't pan out. And so I think, you know, you need to be able to do both of those things and bridge those gaps. And I think the main thing for me is just making sure that you're really, really clear about like what we have now, like what are practical things you can deliver and what is vision, and just separating between the two. Mm-hmm. So like on calls with customers, I will like happily wax lyrical about all the cool shit I think we're going to do in the future. But I'll be like, that's the future. Today, here are the things that we can do. And we do them really, really well. And being able to back that up and avoid that murky middle ground where it's like, we kind of do this and it's kind of headed where we're going, but it's not that good. And like, your experience, it's like, have the confidence and conviction in your bits of your product that work really, really well, and sort of mainly focus on that. But don't forget to sort of also sell a bit of that, mm-hmm. that future, right? Because, you know, that's something that everyone wants to kind of think about and aspire to as well.
So I'd love to wrap things up by asking what's next. Like, I think it's fair to say that we're not done, and, you know, we're going to continue to apply some of the principles that we've spoken about throughout this conversation. But Ed, can you speak to, you know, yeah, what's ahead for us?
So I think for us, just in the same way that we started out with AI features through experimentation and fast feedback loops, that's something we'll continue to do internally. So each time there's a new model available, some new technology we're excited by, or even just the steady performance improvements that we're seeing over time, we track that internally for all our existing features. We'll continue to think of ways that we can leverage that, have little experiments, even if it's just like in a Jupyter notebook or something, and then maybe something for our account, and then maybe something with design partners. Just keeping that tight loop as technology progresses is something we'll always be kind of responsive to.
Yeah. And I think sort of like, you know, the question then becomes sort of like, what can we do? Like, what kind of experience would we do? What would we build? Mm-hmm. And I think that's where, you know, not to sort of steal Ed's thunder, but like, you know, we had loads of good chats about this. We got like ideas coming out of our ears. And I think, you know, some of the stuff that I'm particularly excited by, I think there's a really, really awesome opportunity to leverage AI, not just in like taking lots of context and summarizing it or like finding similarities. Those are the places where we've predominantly focused right now. I think one of the places where it could be incredibly impactful is taking huge amounts of structured information. For example, we have people with loads of data in their catalog, which is our kind of service catalog offering. We have loads and loads of data around, like, you know, your workflows and how you automate things during incidents. And like, with all of that, like, could we suggest new versions of that? Could we say like, you know, hey, you've got workflows to cover all of these use cases. What if you had a workflow to cover this use case? And like, could AI propose new workflows, right? It's like, you know, if we want to do this human in the loop approach, like, you know, one version is the kind of agentic, like AI does the thing. The other world is like the AI proposes the efficiency improvements, or says like, hey, it turns out like every time this kind of incident happens, you invite Luis. Would you like to just like bake that in as like a general rule so that it happens every time? And it's like, that's pretty cool. Like, we could definitely do that. Or for example, tell us a bit about yourself and how your incident process works, like ingest all of your existing process documentation, and we will sort of imply or infer how you should configure your account. Like, I think some of that AI to help you accelerate onboarding and configuration, that's something that I'd really love to explore. And then my personal like thing that I would love to see, I think we recently launched, you know, an on-call product, and we have this great mobile app now, and I think that's a whole new surface. And if you think about like a busy exec, there's a model of AI or LLM interaction with our incidents at the moment that we don't have, which is the kind of, I guess, like conversation with an incident, for want of a better term. And it's like, it's the classic, like CEO comes in and says like, I have questions. If those questions have already been answered in the channel, like we should be able to help somehow, like, you know, join those dots and bridge that gap. And I can imagine some sort of really awesome conversational interface that, like, you know, if it can't answer it, you escalate to the lead and it becomes a question in the channel. But like, can I ask questions of an incident that is live? Like, that would be really, really cool. But these are just, you know, we've got 100 more ideas just like this one. But yeah, that's all to come. Lots of exciting things planned.